the author of this series and the accompanying study guide entitled Let's Get Biblical. He has been a frequent guest on television and on radio shows, and it's my sincere pleasure to introduce Rabbi Sylvia Singer.
Walking around with a piece of plumbing here. I think it's quite timely that we are doing this evening's program and initiating it on Hanukkah. Hanukkah, we celebrate a very special moment in Jewish history when the Jewish people came together and responded to a terrible calling of assimilation. The Greeks wanted the Jewish people to abandon their Jewish faith and heritage. It's ironic, by the way, that we're asked to believe that although the Almighty had written the Bible in the Hebrew language, He inspired His prophets to pen the Jewish scriptures in the holy tongue, the Hebrew language. Somehow, only 2 centuries after Hanukkah, which was a victory over Greece, over Greek culture, somehow God is now writing His Bible in Greek. Interesting. There was a great sage who lived a number of centuries ago. His name was the Duvna Magid. Duvna Magid was noted as a master of the metaphor. He was able to communicate complex ideas through a story. And he tells one such story of a very young prince, only an adolescent. All of his life he lived under the protective walls of his father's palace. Huge palace, large grounds, enormous wall. He had never seen what was on the other side of that wall, only from a distance from his window. And he was very curious. He wanted to know what was there beyond the walls of this fortress. Duvna Magid continues to tell the story how one day he snuck out. He walked through the door and he started to walk through the forest that he only had seen all of his life from a great distance from his window. And he was amazed at everything. As he walked, he saw the trees and the forest and the brush. And suddenly, as he was walking, he came upon a tree that had on it an archer's target. An archer's target is a round target with a circle within another circle, each one a different color. And he realized that clearly someone had already been there, because an arrow had been shot into it. And what amazed him was that the arrow that was shot in was a perfect bullseye. It was not only located in the center circle, but it was located in the right in the middle of the center circle. And he was amazed. He was curious. Who is this archer? Perfect shot, right in the middle. And as he pondered, he decided to keep walking. And it wasn't another 20 feet that he had paced that suddenly he comes to a second tree. And again, archer's target. Someone had been there, because again there was a bullseye, a perfect shot. Not just in the center circle, but right in the middle of the center circle. And now his curiosity was becoming heightened. Who is this archer? 2 in a row? One right after the other? Perfect bullseye, each one? And Duvna Magid describes how he comes to a third tree and the same thing, fourth, fifth. He finally comes to the 10th tree. All the other 9 previously, perfect bullseye. And the 10th once again. But this time there was this big fat fellow standing underneath that tree. And he had a bow in his hand. And immediately the prince ran over to him and said, "Sir, are you the one that shot all of these shots, perfect bullseye, everyone?" And the man said, "I am." And the prince said, "You're the most amazing archer I'd ever seen. There's no one in my father's own crack elite unit that could shoot this well." And as the prince was saying this to the fat guy began to laugh. Oh boy, did he laugh. And the prince was becoming very agitated. He turned to him, "What are you laughing at? What's so funny?" And he said, "Let me tell you how I do this. The first thing I do is I shoot an arrow into a tree and then I just paint a target around it." Christianity did not begin in a vacuum. Evangelical Christians will tell you, evangelical Christians will tell your children, missionaries will tell those who you love, they will say unto you, look at your own Bible, Jesus is there. You have to understand that Christianity believed that it was a continuum of Judaism. It was the true and rightful heir to the biblical faith of what Christians call the Old Testament. And its foundling, Jesus, well, Jesus is the Messiah of the Jewish Scriptures. Now, if the church wanted you to believe that Jesus was indeed the rightful Messiah to the Old Testament faith, they had to do a couple of things. You see, in order to make Jesus appear in the Jewish Scriptures, two things had to be done. Number one, the Jewish Scriptures had to be altered in order to make it appear Christological. The second thing that had to happen was Jesus' life had to be shaped in order to make it appear as if it fits the messianic parameters of the Jewish Scriptures. Now, we do not have the time this evening to examine every single proof text that Christendom has used to demonstrate that Jesus is indeed the Messiah of the Jewish Scriptures. We have a couple of more lectures coming up, and we'll examine many different texts, but tonight we're going to do something special. Tonight we're going to look at the techniques. We're going to very carefully examine how did the church alter the Jewish Scriptures to make them appear Christological. I'm going to take you by the hand this evening, and we're going to go on a journey. We're going on a journey through the Bible. Now, the first technique and the most prominent technique is a technique simply called taking a verse out of context. Now, sometimes when I bring that up, people raise their hand and say, hey, Rabbi Singer, hold on. What do you mean when you say take a verse out of context? What does the church accomplish by altering, by ripping a verse out of its intended context? So what I'd like to do with you is, I would like to first give you an example of what I mean by this. And this one is crucial, because this technique of ripping a verse out of its original context in the Jewish Scriptures is the most pervasive technique used by the church to make Jesus appear in our Jewish Scriptures. So I want to give you an example of this. Now, in the book of Matthew, and I sort of want to stop right there, in the book of Matthew, and we're going to be spending a lot of time in the book of Matthew. Why Matthew? Well, there are 27 books in the Christian Bible, in the New Testament. The first four are Gospels. The word Gospel has an Anglo-Saxon derivative. It simply means good news. But the four Gospels purport to tell the life, the ministry of Jesus. But each Gospel writer, each author is writing for a different audience. You see, as an example, Luke, or the third gospel, he's writing with a Greek audience in mind, and Mark is writing with a Roman audience in mind, Matthew is writing with a Jewish or Hebrew audience in mind, and John, he's writing already in the beginning of the second century, he's writing to the church in general. Now, what are the implications of this? I'll tell you. You see, you may find a similar story both in the book of Matthew and the book of Luke. But because Matthew was writing with a Jewish audience in mind, Matthew does something more than anybody else. He wants you to know that this is not an arbitrary event. This thing that Jesus did, this is not an arbitrary event at all. This is a fulfillment of the Jewish prophets. This is a fulfillment of what the Jewish Scripture said the Messiah would do. I could prove to you that this is not an arbitrary event in Jesus' life. Oh no! This is fulfillment! And I'm going to show you a verse from the Jewish Scriptures. So Matthew wants to prove more than any other gospel writer that indeed this is fulfillment, this is not arbitrary, but I can prove to you, if you just look at your own Bible, Jesus is there. He's bouncing off every page. Pray that Satan would take that veil off of your eyes, the scales over your eyes. Look at your Bible, Jesus is there. He's right there. He's in the Jewish Scriptures. Matthew is doing this. He wants to prove something. By the way, one little point. Ironic, most missionaries, you know, it's funny, It's often been said that at least Catholics know that so much of what they believe is church tradition. Protestants walk around, sola scriptura, we only believe in the Bible. They don't realize how much they have. They've inherited from the Catholic Church. When we say Matthew said this in the book of Matthew, it's not like the book of Matthew ends and says, yours truly, Matthew, your good friend Matthew. No, this is a church tradition, a Catholic church tradition, that Matthew Levi, is the author of the first gospel. That's why scholars usually refer to it as the first, second, third gospel. Luke does not end by saying, your good friend Luke. No, it doesn't end that way. The only thing we're sure of, or pretty sure of, whoever wrote the third gospel, called Luke, also wrote the book of Acts. But we're going to use the name that's part of a church tradition. Now, in the beginning of the book of Matthew, and I want to give you just an example of what I mean by verse out of context. Let me give you an example. In the very early life of Jesus, as we're told by Matthew, there was a very serious problem because Herod the Great, finds out from some astrologers, from some wise men, that there was a boy who was born in Bethlehem. But he wasn't any boy. He was going to be the king of the Jews. Now, Jews, that's not... probably Satan, so don't worry about that. Herod is not the kind of person that wants to hear that there's someone who was arisen, who was born, who was going to be king of the Jews. He was the kind of fellow that would kill his wife and children if he thought they were going to usurp his authority. So the New Testament tells us that Herod basically sends people to find out what's going on. Little Jesus, Matthew tells us, is in very serious trouble. He's got to get out of the country. He's got to be whisked away. He has to go somewhere that's not under Herod's jurisdiction. A little point, by the way, according to Matthew, Jesus was born with a contemporary of Herod the Great. Herod the Great, by the way, is dead in 4 BCE. Therefore, according to Matthew, Jesus was born around the year 6 or 7 BCE. According to Luke, by the way, Jesus wasn't born yet. According to Luke, Jesus was born at the time of the taxation and the census by Quirinus, the governor, and we know that's in the year 6 CE, so there's a disagreement between Matthew and Luke on when Jesus was born, and the difference is about a decade. But let's take Matthew. It's not like Matthew could have got on the phone and said, hey, Luke, what did you write? You know, we want to... can't do that. Couldn't email each other. There was no... so you have these problems. This problem, by the way, is called the gospel problem, but this is not going to be the fabric of this evening's program. So suddenly an angel of the Lord comes to citizens. An angel of the Lord comes to Joseph, Mary's husband, in a dream by night and says, hey Joseph, quickly get Jesus out of here. Take the mother and take Jesus and go to Egypt and be there until I give you word. You have got to go to Egypt because Egypt was outside of the jurisdiction of Herod the Great. Is this an arbitrary event that little Jesus, that the Messiah as a child, had to go to Egypt? Absolutely not. Matthew wants you to know that this is not arbitrary at all. But indeed, the very Jewish prophets foretold that the Messiah himself was going to be taken as a child to Egypt. This is not arbitrary. I can prove to you that your Old Testament foretold that the Messiah, the child, was supposed to go to Egypt. Let's take a look at the original text, and hopefully all of you have access to one of these study guides. And I want to draw your attention to the upper left-hand corner of the first page. If you don't have a study guide, I would encourage you to change your seat and sit down next to someone who does so you can look in. If you can share with somebody else and you have two, and you can pass that to someone who doesn't have one, we'd appreciate that. Let's take a look. Now, we're interested in these three verses on the upper left-hand corner. We're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 2, verse 13 through 15. Follow along with me, if you would. That of the King James. And when they were departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise, and take the young child and his mother, and flee into Egypt. And be thou there until I bring thee word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. Verse 14, when he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night, and departed into Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, and this is the quote from the Jewish scriptures, in black, bold and italics, and here it is, out of Egypt have I called my son. Very simple story. So this is not an arbitrary event Matthew wants you to know. But don't you know, I can prove to you from your Jewish scriptures that the Jewish prophet himself foretold that the Messiah himself would be taken as a little boy into Egypt. Very simple. Now I want you to know that this verse does exist. If you had a Christian study Bible, if you had a Christian study Bible with little footnotes next to it, cross-references, it would tell you that this verse can actually be found in the book of Hosea. Hosea, by the way, was a contemporary of Isaiah. And it can be found in Hosea chapter 11, verse 1. But before we look at it, I want you to know that Matthew does something here a little unusual. What does he do? He actually, although he quoted the verse, and this verse does exist, he actually only quotes half the verse. Again, although Matthew is quoting in the New Testament a verse from the Jewish scriptures, I want you to know that Matthew only quotes half, the second half of the verse. And the question is why? Why would Matthew feel so compelled to only quote half the verse? And the answer is, ladies and gentlemen, he had no choice. He had no choice. Because had Matthew quoted in the New Testament this verse from Hosea in its entirety, it would become immediately apparent to the reader of the New Testament that this verse is not referring to the Messiah at all. It's referring to something else entirely different. Now, I've done the homework for you, so if you look at the upper right-hand side of the same page, let's see how the verse appears in its entirety in context. When Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. Now we understand exactly why Matthew couldn't possibly quote this verse in its entirety, because had Matthew done that, it would become immediately evident to the reader that this verse is not referring to the Messiah at all, but it's referring to something else. What is it referring to? It's referring to Israel. So God speaks to the Jewish people and about the Jewish people in the singular throughout the Jewish scriptures. So it's very convenient by simply marking it off. He just quotes, when is out of Egypt have I called my son. Now, I don't want anyone to get all excited about this. This is not a big deal. This is here as a model for you, so that this evening and the next Sunday night and the Sunday night that will follow, when I use the term take a verse out of context, you will know exactly what I mean by that. This is simply a model. This is just an example for you, just to acquaint you with this concept. By the way, remember, this is a side note, this really is a side note. When Matthew is quoting this, he's saying that little Jesus has to be taken to Egypt, and here's the verse. But let me ask you a question. Is this verse really referring to an entrance into Egypt, or is Hosea really referring to an exodus from Egypt? Referring to an exodus. It's completely misapplied as well. That's just an example. Let's not get all excited about it. Let's get our hands really dirty now. Let's get into the meat and potatoes. Let's see what missionaries are using in order to get our loved ones to abandon the faith they know so little about. I want to direct your attention to the extreme lower left-hand corner of this page, and we're going to the book of Zechariah. Zechariah lived a little later than Hosea. He was one of the last prophets of the Jewish people. He lived about 2,500 years ago. Watch with me, and we're interested in Zechariah chapter 13. We're particularly interested in verse 6. Watch with me. And one shall say unto him, last verse on the page, what are these wounds in thine hands? Then he shall answer, those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends. And one shall say unto him, what are these wounds in thine hands? Then he shall answer, those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends. And ladies and gentlemen, I'd like you to be honest with me. Who does that sound like it might be speaking about? Sure does sound like it might be speaking about Jesus, am I right? Wounds in his hands? I mean, Zechariah is talking about a historical figure here. It certainly sounds like a crucifixion. As a matter of fact, the very well-known was a very well-known Christian apologist, Josh McDowell, in his book called Evidence That Demands a Verdict, over and over again, he shows this verse and points it out. Zechariah 13:6, Matt. This is speaking about the crucifixion. Get with the program. Thomson's chain reference Bible, really a very well done work, tells us that this is the sufferings of Christ right there on the side of the page. The well-known missionary out of Washington, right out of here, he's plagued our nation for many years now, his name is Sid Ross. Sid Ross has a tape called Secrets from the Jewish Scriptures. It's designed for evangelical Christians who are a little timid about evangelizing their next-door neighbor or co-worker. So what it is a tape from the Jewish Scriptures. All it is quotes from the Jewish Scriptures, and he's encouraging his Christian supporters to get this tape and to simply give it to your Jewish neighbor. Let them listen to it. Sid Roth is so confident that any Jew who might listen to this tape would accept Jesus, that at the end of the tape, he calls the listener to accept Jesus. And he uses this verse. I'll play it for you here. Get a kick out of it.
And should someone say unto him, what are these wounds between thy hands? Then will he say, those with which I have been wounded in the house of my friend.
Nice music, no? Nice music. It does a good job. By the way, who else really could this be speaking about? A well-known figure in history? Watch out for the wounds between his hands. He'll tell you, I received them in the house of my friend. By the way, let's be honest, it sure does sound like it's speaking about Jesus. And by the way, one little point, and that is, I think this verse may very well be speaking about Jesus. I just saw three people in the back checking, honey, did we come to the right lecture? Are you sure? You did check the sign as we drove through. You know, sometimes you're not so careful. This verse may very well be speaking about Jesus, but if it is, it's not the Jesus missionaries envisioned. Listen carefully. One of the most important messianic prophecies in the Jewish scriptures is that when the Messiah comes, in the messianic age is ushered in, all false religions will fall away. Most important thing, all the nations of the world will recognize the one God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Zechariah 8:23, remember when the Messiah comes, put on a coat with big, big long tails on it, because Gentiles are going to be grabbing it, tells us that 10 Gentiles of different languages will grab the shirt of a Jew and say, take us with you, because now we know that God is with you. The most important thing is that the Gentile nations will instantly recognize their error, and they will all embrace the Jewish faith. They won't convert to Judaism, they can't any longer. But what they will do at that special moment is they're going to go up to the mountain of the Lord, as Isaiah 2 describes. And indeed in Jeremiah 31 it tells us that when the Messiah comes, we're not going to have to teach anybody about God any longer. That's right. Because everyone will already know Him, from the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord. We sing it in shul, do we not? V'ne'emar v'hoyo Hashem l'melech al... What do you think that is? A signal to fold up your talis? No, not at all. Oh, there's the tune, Sherry. Do you have the keys? No, I have the keys. Okay, you get the car, bring it around. I'll schlep out the baby carriage. That's the tune, right? The tune, yes. That's the smell the chicken soup. The gefilte fish already. Oh, finally, I was really counting the pages. Oh, they're playing that tune. It's time to go. It's a magnificent verse. It actually comes funny, huh? From Zechariah, the next chapter, Zechariah chapter 14. In those days, in the Messianic age, God's name will be one, He'll be one, all the nations will recognize that. Question, if everything truly is in the Bible, what do you think the Reverend Sung Young Moon is going to say when the Messiah comes? What is going to be on the lips of all the false prophets and soothsayers? I mean, God is going to cleanse this all out. Zechariah 13 is a very special messianic chapter, and it begins by describing and giving us the narrative of what the Gentile or Jewish false prophets, what they're going to say at the end of days. And Zechariah 13 describes, it opens up by telling us that God will open a fountain for the house of David. That's another way of saying that the Messiah is here. And when that happens, God is going to clean out all the false spirits, all these false religions, they're over. And indeed, it's interesting, Zechariah tells that if any guy, any missionary, has the chutzpah to still be standing on the street corners passing out tracts in the time when the Messiah actually comes, his own parents will put him to death, because they're going to say, "You're speaking lies in the name of the Lord." And each prophet will stand up and articulate and say, "I really am no prophet. I am so ashamed of what I have done." And then Zechariah tells us something fascinating. He tells us there's going to be one of these false prophets, and obviously a person who is incredibly important. Suddenly, Zechariah focuses in on one false prophet. And he describes how people will come over to this false prophet at the end of days and ask him, "Hey, but what are these wounds in your hands?" And he's going to say, "Those are the wounds that I received in the house of my friend." Let's take a look at Zechariah 13, but not how missionaries present it. Let's take a look at it in context, from verse 1. "In that day there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanliness. And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols out of the land, and they shall no more be remembered. And also I will cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land." Verse 3. "And it shall come to pass that when any shall hear prophecy, then his father and his mother that begot him shall say unto him, Thou shalt not live, for thou speakest lies in the name of the Lord. And his father and mother that begot him shall thrust him through when he prophesies. And it shall come to pass in that day that the prophet shall be ashamed, every one of his vision when he hath prophesied. Neither shall they wear a rough garment to deceive, but he shall say, I am no prophet. I am a husbandman, for man taught me to keep cattle from my youth. And one shall say unto him, What are these wounds in thine hands? Then he shall answer, Those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends." Do you get it? If indeed this verse is speaking about Jesus of Nazareth, as Sid Roth wants you to believe, it may very well be, but if it is, it's not the Jesus of Nazareth that these missionaries envision. It's a false prophet. By the way, how could Jesus of Nazareth be the person people are coming over to when the Messiah comes? He's long dead and buried. Interesting, in Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, when it describes the resurrection of the dead, it tells us that not only will the righteous be resurrected, but also those who had sinned, and they will be resurrected so the world can see their contempt and derision. Taking the verse out of context, notice the difference. Notice the stark contrast. Out of context, sounds like it's speaking about Jesus, perhaps the crucifixion. In context, it still might be speaking about Jesus, but not Jesus, the Messiah. Let's turn the page. I want to read to you a verse that comes from the book of Psalms, and it's the 22nd Psalm, and it's in a Jewish Bible. It appears as verse 17, and just so you should know, in a Christian Bible, it appears as verse 16, and that happens sometimes. I don't want to go into this, but what Christian Bibles do is at the opening clause of the book of Psalms, of many of the Psalms, they don't consider a verse, like Mizmor LeDavid, that's sort of a heading. And then when they have thought verse 1, that's actually our verse 2. But the point is, the verse we're going to be studying, if you look in a Jewish Bible, it would appear as Psalm 22, verse 17. And if you look in any Christian Bible, it would appear as Psalm 22, verse 16. Let me read to you. Read along with me, if you would. Upper right-hand corner. This is a Jewish translation. "For dogs have encompassed me, a company of evildoers have enclosed me, like a lion, they're at my hands and my feet." By the way, who is that speaking about? Okay. Let me read that verse to you again, that exact same verse, but this time as it appears in a Christian Bible. In this case, it's a King James. Watch along with me. Christian Bible, same exact verse. "For dogs have compassed me. The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet." Be honest. Who does that sound like it might be speaking about? Who does that sound like it might be speaking about? Now, you all laugh, but what does it sound like it might be speaking about? Just say it. Jesus, exactly. Now, When I asked you this question the first time I read it to you, you really weren't sure who was speaking. I asked you, who's it speaking about? And it was silent. 100 Jews silent to say, right? Not a word out of you. If I read the exact same verse to you the second time, just as it appears in the Christian Bible, and suddenly all of you started chuckling and laughing, and you all knew it sounds like it's speaking about Jesus. And tell me something. Now, why is that? What was it about when I read that verse to you the second time that made you think it sounds Christological? What was the word? What's the key phrase? It appears. There's only one little problem. The word pierce appears nowhere in the original Hebrew, and I've given you the Hebrew on the right side. The word pierce doesn't exist there, but you see the word that's pointed out there? What word is the church altered in order to make it appear Christological? What's the Hebrew word? Ka'ari. And what is ka'ari? What's an ari? An ari isn't a dog, and it's not a giraffe. What's an ari? Lion. Technique number two. You simply take one word, and you change it, and suddenly you have a brand new message. The word ka'ari means like a lion. In the English language, when we say like something, like a table, we say L-I-K-E. We put that before the table, the noun, right? Well, in the Hebrew language, it's a much more compressed language. All we do is put a little kaf before it, and that kaf, like kashulchan, means like a table. Ka'ari means like a lion. All you do is change one word in the verse, and suddenly we have a brand new message. Are you getting the message, by the way? What makes our young men and women so vulnerable to these groups? And ari is a very common word. By the way, some of you might be wondering, saying, hey, Rabbi, it all sounds well and fine, but you know, my co-worker, Christian, she doesn't speak Hebrew. She's going to tell me, and if you don't know this, she will tell you, say, you know, the rabbis changed it. The word ka'ari, Christians might tell you, is really does mean pierce. But the rabbis didn't want you to believe in Jesus, so they changed it to be translated to mean like a lion. Could anyone here think of an objective technique how we can prove, I mean, someone's not telling the truth? If I may be so vulgar, somebody is lying. How can we prove it to someone who doesn't even understand Hebrew? Can anyone think of a technique we can use? Go ahead. Listen to this man very carefully. There are more than 30,000 verses in the Jewish scriptures. Don't you think this very simple word appears in other places? Actually, the word ka'ari, in all of its variations, appears 91 times. This is one of them, which tells us there are 90 other places where this word appears. Any of you want to guess how the exact same King James translates that exact same word in every other place it appears? Only here appears. I wonder why. Now, what you need for this is a computer with a Bible program or a concordance. I've done a little bit of the homework for you, walking around here so much, I don't know why I put my hand out. And what I did was, if you look down at row C, all I did was I found another place where that exact same word appears in the Hebrew. And it's in Isaiah chapter 38, verse 13. Look at the Hebrew. Shivisi ad boker ka'ari. There is the exact same word. Well, let's see what the King James does with that exact same word in Isaiah 38, verse 13. I reckon till morning that as a lion. Why? Tell me, King James. Tell me, why do these 54 scholars decide in the 17th century to somehow ka'ari in Isaiah 38, 13 means like a lion, but somehow in Psalm 22 it means fierce? You know, the absurdity of all this, by the way, is King David, throughout this psalm, uses the lion and the dog as a metaphor for his enemies. Many people wanted to kill King David, his own son, his predecessor, Saul. And he uses the animal motif throughout this psalm. Look at row B, you'll see there, right before this psalm, verse 16 or 17 in question, you'll see there, verse 13, they gaped upon me with their mouth as raving and roaring lions. And look over here at verse 21. These are only a few verses later. What we're doing is now we're looking at a few verses earlier, a few verses later. Save me from the lion's mouth. Right before this verse, King David is speaking about a lion. And there, the King James translates it correctly as a lion. And a little bit afterwards, again, lion, but right in the middle, pierced. Technique number two. You simply change one word in the verse, and suddenly we have a brand new message. Now, remember earlier we talked about little Jesus being brought to Egypt as a child. Well, you know what? Herod is dead. Right? You know, ding dong, the king is dead, right? Well, now Jesus could go back to Israel. Now, by the way, according to Matthew and Luke, what city was Jesus born in? Bethlehem. Matthew and Luke. Now, when he comes back from Egypt, does he settle in Bethlehem? Does he go back to the city of Bethlehem that he was born in? No. He goes to what city? Nazareth. The guy should know your Chumash like you know your New Testament. You'd be okay. Is that an arbitrary event according to Matthew? Is it an arbitrary event that little Jesus is a resident of Nazareth? Oh, no. Don't you know that the Jewish prophets foretold that the Messiah himself would be indeed a Nazarene? He would be a resident of Nazareth? Let's take a look at the very bottom of the same page. Remember, now we're a little further. Before we were Matthew 2, verse 13 through 15. Now we're in Matthew 2, 23. Let's take a look at this verse. And he came and dwelt, same page. And he came and dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophets, and this is the quote, he shall be called a Nazarene. Very simple, right? By the way, I don't know, any of you study the prophets? Any people here? Any of you, let me ask this way. Any of you know where this verse is? Do you know which sefer this comes from? If you don't know, it's not a big deal. What'd you say? Not Samuel, but very good, close. Which book in the Jewish scriptures does this come from? You don't, really, you don't know? No. He is a Nazarite. She said, Samson, there were people who took a vow not to cut their hair or drink any wine. They're called a Nazir. Now, although when we anglicize the word, it sounds the same, it's really quite different, because a Nazir in Hebrew is spelled Nun, next letter, Zion. And the city of Nazareth is Nazareth, and therefore that's spelled Nun, Sadi. Two different words. Anyone know what book it is? Really? Nobody here? Myrtle of Myrtle? It's not like Wyoming or something. You guys should know. Isaiah? No. Actually, ladies and gentlemen, don't feel bad. Don't feel bad. Put away your, don't worry. Actually, the reason why you shouldn't feel bad about knowing where this verse is simply this. It doesn't exist. Week number three is, if you don't have a verse, you simply invent one. There is no such verse anywhere in the Jewish scriptures. I was just playing with you here. By the way, not only doesn't this verse exist, the city of Nazareth never appears anywhere in the Jewish scriptures. Open up a Strong's exhaustive concordance of the Bible, look up Nazareth or Nazar anything, and Strong's will tell you that the very first time this verse appears anywhere in what Christians call a Bible, right here in Matthew 2:23. Let's turn the page. The last series of verses we're going to examine this evening are a series of verses and a idea subject that I'm sure many of you here have some familiarity with, and I hope I can shed more light onto it. Now, the next series of verses is the subject of the virgin birth. I'm sure some of you have some knowledge of this. I hope we'll see if we can enhance that a little bit, color it up a little bit for you. Now, it's called, in this study of biblical polemics, this verse from Isaiah, actually, is called a textbook verse. Now, why does it get that name? It's called a textbook verse sometimes because it actually contains within it every technique the church ever conceived in order to alter and doctor the Jewish scriptures. Let me show you what I mean. Now, to begin with, you should know that there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different Christian denominations in the world. Many different flavors. And you think, there's all Catholic, all kinds. Within Protestantism, there's East and West, within Catholicism, and so on. Now, although mainline Christians disagree on a lot of things, from the Trinity to predestination, the one thing they don't disagree on is the virgin birth, meaning that Jesus was not conceived of the natural intimate union of a man and a woman. Intimate union is the rabbinical way of saying sex. It is, but rather his mother Mary was a virgin when she had conceived with him in her womb. Now, I want you to know that, as I said earlier, there are 27 books in the New Testament. Only two of them ever mention the virgin birth, and that's, of course, the book of Matthew and the book of Luke. And remember the rule I shared with you earlier? Although two of them might be describing a similar event, whereas Luke will simply tell the event, Matthew is going to take us one step further. He's speaking to the Jew. And he's saying to you, I've got something to prove to you. I want to demonstrate to you that it's not an arbitrary event that the Messiah will be born of a virgin. It was foreordained. It was prophesied. Indeed, the Jewish prophet himself foretold that the Messiah will be born of a virgin. I can prove to you that Jesus is the promised Jewish Messiah because here we have a prophecy. Now, the way Matthew describes it in chapter 1, it's simple, very simple. Joseph is betrothed to Mary. Okay? She's still a virgin. And she finds out that she's pregnant. Now, Joseph, of course, knew that he certainly had nothing to do with it. And he, therefore, wants to divorce her. He wants to terminate this relationship. I mean, she clearly had been unfaithful to him. So he was considering putting her away privately. He didn't want to make a public example out of her, but he had to terminate the relationship. He had to essentially divorce her. Now, when he was considering divorcing her, suddenly Joseph gets a dream. And an angel of the Lord comes to Joseph in a dream by night and says, "Hey, Joseph, thou son of David, put not away. Don't divorce Mary your wife, because that which is within her womb is of the Holy Ghost. And she's going to have a little boy, and the little boy's name is going to be called Jesus, for he's going to save his people from their sins." Is this an arbitrary event? No. The writer of the first gospel wants you to know this is hardly an accident, but indeed the prophets foretold that the Messiah would be born of a virgin woman. Let's take a look at the text inside, if you would. It's on the top of the next page. It's Matthew chapter 1, first chapter, verses 20 through 24. But when he had considered this, when who considered what? When Joseph considered divorcing Mary, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, "Joseph, thou son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for that which has been conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit, and she will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus,